Welcome to the Devin Nunes Podcast, breaking through the political noise, separating fact from fiction. From the San Joaquin Valley, the breadbasket of the solar system, here is your host, Devin Nunes.
Welcome back to the Devin Nunes Podcast. I know this is a tough week for everyone with the coronavirus fears that are out there, but I thought it would be good this week to bring back on classicist historian with the Hoover Institute, Victor Davis Hanson, who served a long time at CSU Fresno, has been on the Stanford campus now for, I think, over a decade, but really looks at historical, puts things into historical perspective. I think it's important for our audience to know that this is not the first pandemic. We have faced these issues before, and I thought I'd bring on Victor to walk us back through some of the most famous ones throughout history and then bring us up into the 20th century, some of the major ones there, and then, of course, that led to the coronavirus up today. So, Victor, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a while since you've been on. Last time we had you on, we actually went over your book on World War II, which a lot of people really enjoyed. So welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Devin.
Well, Victor, why don't we just start with what are the most famous pandemics that people would think of, and maybe there's facts that they may not know dating back several hundred years?
Well, I think the most well-known, three or four of them very quickly, was the plague of 430, 431 BC that hit Athens in the age of Pericles, killed Pericles, second year of the Peloponnesian War with Sparta, and wiped out a fourth of the population. And we have a really gripping description of it in Thucydides, the contemporary historian, in his second book. And what's famous for it is not just he gives us the symptoms, and we don't know what it was, typhus, typhoid, black bubonic plague, smallpox, people still don't know. But his description of the panic that started, and he's got a great line about people who said they were virtuous and were going to help the sick who were abandoned, and they died in droves. And it's kind of a really gripping description. And then the religious and superstitious, both bad and good, reactions to it at Athens. And militarily, it meant that Athens in the next 26 years could not win the war. They didn't lose it necessarily because of the plague, but they couldn't win it. They had lost so much manpower. A really famous one was, more famous even, was the Emperor Justinian in the 6th century AD, roughly 1,000 years later, in 541 AD at Constantinople. We know that was caused by lice and rats and the Black Plague, which was bubonic plague. What was interesting about that is the Roman Empire had fallen for a century, 100 years in the West, but it was still in the East, very viable. And Justinian was sort of a Renaissance figure, and he thought he was going to restore the entire Roman world all the way from Britain to the Persian Gulf and, you know, from the Rhine River to the Atlas Mountains in Africa. And he almost did. He had his great generals Narses and Belisarius recovering Italy from the so-called barbarians. They recovered a lot of the Balkans. They recovered all of North Africa. They built Hagia Sophia, the beautiful cathedral you see, Santa Sophia in Constantinople, or today's Istanbul. The Justinian law codes. The whole course of history was starting to revert back to Rome, and then this plague hit the city of Constantinople, and it wiped out 500,000 people out of 2 million, and then it spread throughout the empire. And then, unfortunately, within 100 years, Islam rose, and so the Byzantines lost somewhere between 2 to 3 million. It hit the army especially hard. They lost all of their Western conquest, and then Islam took over most of their Eastern territory. They survived for 1,000 years, but it was the dream of Justinian was over because of that plague. And the description is in the historian Procopius, and it's like Thucydides. It's very moving about the psychological. Again, they're very interested in the psychological effects of panic, hysteria, accusations, ostracism, etc.
Question on that, because a lot of people may know, you talked about the Church of Sophia was built. That was originally built as a Christian church, but now still stands today as one of the most famous sites in what was the Ottoman Empire and is an Islamic site today that's right in, as you said, Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. I just wanted to clarify. So this was around 600 AD, the Justinian period?
541, the plague broke out. AD, yeah. And then the cathedral had just been finished. Now, that cathedral existed as a Christian, the site of Christian orthodoxy for 900 years. And then on May 29th, 1453, with that great scene in some of our contemporary historians of the Byzantine Empire, when the Muslims, the Turks, broke in, they slaughtered 7,000 inside the walls of the church. They kept praying for the Archangel Mark to come down and save them, looted the church, and then within 10 years, they put minarets on it. And then next to it, later, they copied it and made something called the Blue Mosque, which is there. Mm-hmm. It's kind of important because if you go to Istanbul, and I was there 3 years ago, I've been there 10 or 12 times lecturing about it. The Erdogan government wants to return that back in from a World Historic Monument to a mosque again. And that's really scary. They destroyed all the frescoes. The Muslims destroyed all the frescoes that were said to be famous. And that was the largest dome in the world from about 538 until St. Peter's in the 15th century.
So you have the other mosque that's right there, but now it is not, as I recall, they no longer have any type of religious ceremonies there, correct?
No, after the Muslims used it as a mosque, and it was a center mosque, and of course they renamed Constantinople Istanbul. And then during the Ataturk period of secularization in the early 20th century, say from about 1924 up through the 1940s, then Ataturk, who was anti-Muslim in a way, he created that as a national monument without religious significance. And then the UN in the 40s and 50s said it was a world monument. It wouldn't have Christian or Islamic services, and it was just a museum. And that's how we see it today. But the Erdogan government today wants to end that status and return it to a mosque. And they're really facing a lot of pushback. But if you go there today and lecture about it, he has Turkish tourist guides that will be there right with you and correct you if they think you're saying anything that's not orthodoxy or politically correct in terms of Islam.
Sorry for that little venture off path, but I thought for those folks who haven't been there, I think it's a great description you just gave for people to have an understanding. They can look it up online and see that. Okay, so that's the plague of 500 AD. What's the next one?
Well, probably the best known is the so-called Black Plague that hit Europe around 1347 and lasted for on and off for 8 or 9 years. And that, too, was a bubonic plague. And remember, these are bacterial plagues, so they tend to be more intense and more lethal, but they didn't have any cause and effect. That is, the people at the time didn't understand the role of rats and lice. Just like malaria, which in Latin means bad mal area, bad air. They didn't understand the exegesis of malaria. But the same was true of Black Plague, and these crowded, filthy cities of Europe that were much more populated than the East, when that came in the Mediterranean ports, it spread throughout Europe, killed 50 million people within a decade. Many people think it contributed to the end of the medieval world and the beginning of what we later call the Renaissance, in that it destroyed the social hierarchy of the manor. Peasants could not trust in the church anymore. All of the existing establishment had no answers to it. They'd never seen death at this plague. And so people sort of broke away from the feudal system and started to form local guilds, local councils. Artists were more realistic, and I don't know to the degree that that's an accurate generalization, but a lot of art historians and cultural historians believe the Black Plague really marks the end of the medieval world. But it was the most deadly event in human history, except for World War II. World War II killed about 70 million people, and the Black Plague in about 2 years killed 50 million in a much smaller population, but World War II killing 70 million in 4 years.
And then finally, the Black Plague was mostly Europe. Is there anywhere particular that was hardest hit? I know the map, but was not the same in the 1300s. Was it spread equally across of Europe?
Yeah, what we have to remember about Europe is before the discovery of the New World and before the Protestant Reformation and before the rise of the Seljuk Turks, the greatest population and culture was centered in Spain, Spanish, and Italy. And we don't really see the rise of what we call the wealthy Western European countries until the New World, where France and Britain and Western Spain and Netherlands, they all had Atlantic ports. And these countries like Italy did not. And then the Protestant Reformation really swept through Northern Europe more than Southern Europe. And then Southern Europe was on the front lines of these wars with the Ottomans, whereas Northern Europe wasn't. And that explains the shift in power from Southern Europe of antiquity to Northern Europe today. And that's a long explanation of saying that Italy was really hit hard. And you can see it in famous literature such as Boccaccio's Decameron, 10 Stories of 10 Days. It's a great novel about people who are in isolation. And they talk about the stories about basically the end of the medieval world. They don't know they're talking about the end of the medieval world, but it's a valuable historical source. But it's a novel about people who have nothing else to do but tell funny stories. Some of them are quite tragic. And then finally, the most recent was the so-called Spanish flu that probably originated in the United States and Kansas. And that killed about 500,000 Americans in a population of about 120 million. And that swept through Europe in 1918 and 1919. I was born in 1953, and my grandparents were born in 1890. And I'm looking at the house right now as I speak. And they all got that.
Just so everybody knows, just interrupt a second. Victor and I, normally last time we did the podcast, Victor, I went out to your farm, to your house there, and we did it from your kitchen. Yeah. This time we are practicing social distancing. So we're just over the phone. We've got producer Steve in his house. So I just want everybody to know that we are following the rules of the government and the state of California. So sorry about
Thank
that,
you.
Victor. I just want to make sure everybody knew
that. But they both survived the epidemic of 1918. They got the flu. They recovered. But unfortunately, there was a plague, remember, in the 20s of polio. And my aunt, my mother's sister, and their daughter got that plague in, I think it was 1924, swimming in the Selma pool in the summer. And she ended up crippled and stayed her entire life in a living room in a bed. And I remember her dying in 1981. So there's kind of a history of plagues as far as my family and this house go. But finally, in World War II, that killed somewhere between 300,000 and 600,000. People don't really know why that was true, other than, you know, life in the trenches was not sanitary, and there were other diseases that contributed to the fatality rate. Another argument has been that that particular swine flu, something like H1N1 that hit us in 2009, may have been especially lethal for younger people, unlike the coronavirus, because it created a particular type of immune response in healthy individuals. So although it killed a lot of older people, it really took a toll of younger people in a way that coronavirus doesn't. And then the great Spanish flu epidemic of 1918-1919 came out about 10 years after the Bayer Corporation in Germany patented what we call today Bayer aspirin, and out of tree bark from the Amazon basin. Problem with that is nobody knew what the proper dose of that non-steroid anti-inflammatory was. They just thought it was a wonder drug. And so a lot of recent papers, especially in military history, trying to explain why the German army, for example, really took a hit from Spanish flu, and then to a lesser extent the British, was that doctors, when they gave 500 milligrams, 600 milligrams of aspirin per hour, found that the patients had enormously relieved symptoms, and they thought more was better. And they were giving doses equivalent of 30 or 40 or 50 aspirin tablets a day. And we know that one of the symptoms of over-prescribing or overdosing aspirin is pulmonary edema, and that seems to be the chief cause of death in the Spanish flu. So there's a lot of people who have argued that the use of aspirin in its first decade, when no one knew the proper dose, contributed rather than alleviate the death rate. I could just finish with the swine flu. I think you remember that, Devin, of 2009.
I do. I had the swine flu, and I was
I did as well.
And held up in Washington for 2 weeks with originally 103 temperature and a small cough, a lot like what they talk about today with coronavirus, and then had it for just a low-grade fever for about 2 weeks. But yeah, it was really nasty.
It was bad. It was bad. I remember there was a panic in Monterey and Santa Cruz counties because, remember, that particular flu virus strain, H1N1, was lethal for children. We had, I think, 1,000 children nationwide died, and we had 4 or 5 in those two counties that were paralyzed. I think altogether the CDC ended up saying 30 to 60 million, but a more accurate estimate was 50 million people got it, somewhere between 15 and 17,000 dead. And we just shrugged. I think Anthony Fauci even said that it was not, who at that time the assistant director at the CDC said it was not necessary to have a lockdown or mass quarantine, just to be careful. That was when Joe Biden, I remember, got in trouble for saying just get on the plane and travel. But it was much more lethal so far than what we're seeing today. We don't know the ultimate state of the coronavirus.
There's a lot we don't know, and folks that have listened to my podcast the last couple of weeks or the other shows that I've been on, one of the things we really lack right now is good data, because we can't trust anything the Chinese say. When you look at the situation in Italy, where you've got many folks that are older, you've got a lot of Chinese in that area. I think the South Korea data is fairly good. I had a doctor on, Dr. Centano, where we talked about the cruise ship that left from Wuhan province and ended up in Japan. Yeah. That's a pretty good case study. But one of the things that, you know, it appears like right now, at least from the limited data that we have in the United States, is that I think we can all agree that this is a very contagious virus, and it seems like it can move very quickly, where if someone's shedding, all of a sudden you can have 20, 30 people in that same vicinity come down with the, or at least test positive. Now, on the good side of this is the lethality of this does not appear to be as bad as the swine flu, at least in younger people, because we're not losing very many people that are young, where the swine flu hit basically everybody under the age of 80 pretty hard if you came down with it. Right now, you know, I mean, you as a PhD and leading a lot of these studies know that, you know, until we get good data, we won't be able to make these assessments. And that's why it's so hard right now for leaders to predict what is the right public policy to take. Because if you pick the wrong ones, as you talked about here on the podcast today, Victor, it can have lasting damaging effects for our government and our country.
Yeah, I think what's unusual from a historical point of view, if you look back at demographic studies of these outbreaks, we've never done this before where we know the number of the dead, and that's certified pretty accurately by autopsies and hospital death certificates. Now, people have argued, well, nobody dies of coronavirus alone. They die of other areas, illnesses that we're suffering. That's somewhat true of older people, but let's just say that it's accurate. But we've never taken that numerator and then taken the number of cases with an exact figure and divided it into it. And what I mean by that is that if we say 60 million, 50 million had swine flu in 2009, how do we know that? Well, we know that because there were probably 17,000 or 15,000 cases and they were certified. So then we say 1 out of 1,000 gets the flu. So then we extrapolated backwards and guessed from a known figure. But what we're doing now, we're not guessing from the known death number about the number of cases. We're actually using tests. And the problem with that is that we're not even up to 1 million tests out of 330 million people. And the people who do get tested are those who have exposures or they think they have symptoms. And then we're getting about a 90%, I think in California it's 93% negative rate. So there's so many variables that we're really not going to know the extent of this virus until we do one of two things, and that is start massively testing for positives in the many millions, or we take representative samples, let's say take 1,000 people in Tulare or 1,000 people in San Francisco that are mixed examples, and then test for antibodies. Everybody has to be tested for antibodies, and that will tell us the percentage of the population that either has an active case or has had a case. And then we could extrapolate, given the death rate, we could find out And my suspicion is because even when the cases, the tests are showing people who think they're sick, the death rate's gone in the United States from 4 to 3 to 2.5 to 2. And now, depending on the day and the role of New York, it's kind of hovers between 1.4% and 1.2%. But it has right. been going down. And I have a feeling that it's going to go way down if we would get up to 2 or 3 or 4 million. And I think in California is a big mystery so far, because whereas the governor suggested that we might be in the high 50% of 41 million people, and that would be, you know, close to 25, 27 million people are going to get it. So far, the testing shows we're only around 2,500, and we're down to about 60. We only have about 68 deaths. I think Fresno County has 19 cases, zero deaths. And so there has to be an explanation for that. And it's either that our testing is just so behind the schedule of other states, or in November, December, January, all the way to January 31st, but actually probably into mid-February, given people coming directly from China through European flights, you know, getting off the plane for a day and getting on. We were getting almost LAX, SFO in Seattle, probably around 10,000 people arriving per day on direct flights from China, including every other day flights. I think there was 6 a week at SFO and LAX from Wuhan. So my only point is that in that 90-day period, there might have been a lot of people who had this flu and now have immunity. And I'm not just speculating as someone who's not an epidemiologist, but I'm trying to relate what people at Stanford, like Professor Yannanides, and he's one of the world's experts on epidemiology, has written an article and got a lot of flack for it, saying just that. And then if you remember Michael Levitt, he's a Stanford biophysicist, he's in Israel now, but he wrote 2 or 3 articles saying that he agrees entirely with social distancing, etc., but we're reaching a point where the economic damage could hurt more people, and he means hurt in the sense of kill, than the virus itself. And one of the reasons he believes that is he's using modeling from prior flus and the practicality that given the virus has not met the early models of contagion, he thinks it was herd mentality developed from an earlier month or two. And the funny thing is that's exactly what yesterday Oxford University epidemiologists came out and they challenged the Imperial study that said we're all going to get it. It's going to be horrible. And they said the figures don't add up in the UK and the death rate doesn't add up. And one of the reasons it doesn't add up, they believe that there were thousands of Chinese nationals that were going in, and more importantly, on these direct flights from Wuhan, maybe as early as November, people thought, you know what, there's something going on in Wuhan. I want to get out of here. I'm going to take a flight to London or to San Francisco, and that spread.
And the only way we're going to know this, Victor, is we're going to have to go back and look at the folks that did pass away of what probably people thought was the flu or pneumonia in California. What you're saying is it possible that in California we already had many folks that did have it and we just didn't know? I think that is a possibility.
Yeah, I did.
It's one of the things we have to look into at this point.
Yeah. What I did the other day was I went back and took about 7 hours, and I went through Los Angeles Times, San Francisco, and even Fresno Bee news reports of this early flu that was in actually mid-November and December and January. And I wanted to see, what was the official reaction to it, because obviously a lot of people get the flu vaccination in September and August. And the articles were kind of unusual. They said there was a flu virus that was not deterred by the flu vaccination, and they attributed it to kind of a rare influenza B, which is usually only about 15% of cases. And they said, well, in California at least, or the West Coast, or parts of the Western United States, we're not seeing influenza A, we're seeing influenza B. And this year we didn't have enough B strains in the vaccination. And this virus is a little different. It doesn't have a productive cough. It has more muscle cramps, some intestinal problems, a higher fever, but not as long and not as protracted, the febrile state. And a lot of people suggest, well, maybe it wasn't B at all. Maybe it was coronavirus. And then the objection to that was, well, that's kind of early because the first case didn't get to Washington until January, I think 22nd, given what the Chinese have told us that they didn't know about it to mid-December. And then lo and behold, this week, a lot of Italian scholars have come out and said, actually, they know that the virus hit northern Italy in early to mid-November. So I have a feeling that nothing that comes out of China was accurate. And if that were to be true, they knew that people were leaving China sick in early November for Europe, the United States.
Well, we had on Gordon Chang last Friday, and there's not a better expert on China in the country than Gordon Chang. And I totally agree with him, which is you can't trust anything coming from China at all. They helped aid in the panic that ensued because they kept this quiet for so long. And then the first thing we see is we see these hospitals being built overnight, and everybody then globally says, whoa, what's going on? Then, of course, we start to see it, you start to test for it, and you start to get it. And now we're trying to catch up with the data and the facts to match, you know, what are the symptoms? This has been my biggest concern is what are the symptoms, and then what are the best ways to treat this virus? And those are the things we're going to learn over time. But enough of that coronavirus talk, Victor. This is, we don't want to depress everybody, but thank you for the look back in history. But for all those folks that are at home right now, there's not a better classicist historian than you, Victor. What if somebody wants to learn about the classics and they're not a PhD level, but want to either watch a documentary or seeing being that everybody's at home right now, watch a documentary or read a couple books, what would you advise people to go out and check out or rent?
Well, if I was self-interested, we have a scholar who lives in Fresno County. He's at Cal State Fresno and, well, at Stanford at the Hoover. Bruce Thornton wrote a really good book called Greek Ways. You can get it at Amazon, Greek Ways. And it's about what are the values of the ancient world, especially the ancient Greek world. I wrote a book co-authored, Who Killed Homer, about why classics, the study of Greece and Rome, is important and why the universities haven't been emphasizing it to the extent they should. But, you know, I tend to be somewhat skeptical of modern scholarship because I think today's classical scholars don't know Greek and Latin the way that people in our generation were taught, and they write in a race, class, gender focus. So I go back to older things, and one of the best books was Moses Finley and the World of Odysseus. There's another great book by Edith Hamilton, The Greek Way. And then H.D. Kitto, K-I-T-T-O, The Greeks, all these are available on Amazon. And then once you get those general views of who the Greeks and Romans were, what did they contribute to Western civilization, what were their values, what were their accomplishments, then you can get into the real classics like Mommsen's History of the Roman Republic or Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire or books like History of Greece by Grote. And so it's an endless lifelong pursuit, but these earlier books are a good introduction. It's always better.
So what about for that seventh or eighth grader that's at home or a high school student that's at home? If you had one book that they could read to start out with to learn about the classicist history, what would you recommend?
What age group would you
talk
about?
Yeah, just say 13, 12, teenagers.
Children usually want to read about, I don't know why that is, but they usually like to write about Greek mythology. I mean, read about Greek mythology, the Greek gods, the Olympians. And so any book, Gods and Heroes, or there's a whole series of Greek kids' books about, and I don't know particularly which ones are best. There's a guy named Don Matthews that writes a whole series of books for children on Greece. But they're mostly mythological because the Greek myths are much different than any other mythology because they sort of encompass human attributes. They're kind of like comic books. So who's the strongest person in the world? He's got to be Hercules, who's a god. Who's the smartest or the most refined? It's got to be Apollo. Who's the most just? That's Zeus. So they personalize their own experience by creating these anthropomorphic or man-shaped deities. And the weird thing about them is all of these books, and why they're fascinating, they're not moral gods like the Judeo-Christian in the sense that we understand that they're just stronger than we are and they don't die, but they fornicate, they lie, they cheat, and they do all the other things. And then the issue remains, is that a sign of confidence that the Greeks didn't have to have superior beings that were more moral than what was possible on Earth, or was it a sign of their own pessimism and nihilism? So there's an endless books on Greek mythology. And as a child, that's how I think all of us got introduced to it, to the classical world, Treasury of Greek Myth. I remember that was a really good book that I remember.
Well, there we have it, folks. You have your homework given to you by Dr. Victor Davis Hanson. If you want to learn more about the classicist historians and what it's all about, those are books that you can go out and read. And you had your lesson today about the history of pandemics dating from BC all the way up to present day coronavirus. Victor, thank you so much. This has been great to spend this much time with us on the podcast. I can't thank you enough, and I wish I could be at your farm, but we're going to obey our governor right now and our government.
Yes, we have to. Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Devin Nunes Podcast. We invite you to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And remember, you can download this podcast on iTunes or at devinnunes.com.
Storm clouds been gathering so long, I don't know.
The darkness around us leaves no easy road.
We started wondering if every road dead ends our dreams. Wind whips the dust up and rain's pouring down.
Good people struggling in every hometown.
We started wondering if we even matter at all. Days, 'cause we kept our American faith.
Now it's not our first trial by fire like this.
It's nothing hard work and family can fix.
We've got the power to save it all here in our hands. We'll take hard road to happier days. 'Cause we kept our American faith. As we the people free and strong fight through the dark night toward the dawn. We're already half the way there. We'll take that hard road to happier days. 'Cause we've kept our American faith.
Paid for by Devin Nunes Campaign Committee.